Welcome to episode 165 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This week we have Travis Griggs, who is talking about his experience at Smalltalks 2009, the Argentinian Smalltalk conference that just wrapped up this weekend. We ended up spending an awful lot of time talking about Dan Engel's talk at the conference and some ideas and thoughts that spun out of that for Travis. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group of Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning. This is James Robertson, Syncom Small Talk Product Evangelist. I'm here with Michael Lucas Smith, the lead on our Web Velocity project.
G'day.
And also Travis Griggs, recently returned from the Small Talks 2009 conference and also one of our engineers.
G'day.
It's almost Australian.
Almost. It's your turn now, James. Can you say g'day?
No, I haven't gone to Outback enough to be able to do that.
How about Outback Steakhouse?
Yeah. So, Travis, why don't you fill us in on what you give us some top level, high level impressions of what Smalltalks 2009 was like this year?
Well, I've never been before. This is my first one, so I can't compare it to previous years. But everybody there seemed pretty excited. Seemed like this was the biggest event they'd had so far. This, I think, was kind of a seminal year for them because Dan Engels came, and I think that was a pretty big deal and kind of a closure. Closure is the wrong word. That implies a sense of finality, but it was kind of this connection. Squeak is pretty big there in the universities, and they view the work done by the original Xerox team as pivotal. And they've been doing Smalltalk in Argentina for 20 years or more now, and some of the names who were doing it 20 years ago are still there helping with the effort. So it's pretty neat to see that closure, that connection finally happen between them. And Dan was very gracious about it. You know, he, in his comments about why they built Squeak and kind of reaching out to the masses and everyone and enabling people to do cool things, you know, he closed his presentation with was, you know, you people like you are the reason we built Squeak. And the applause was just awesome. I mean, there were a good 100+ people in the room at that point. It was a big circular auditorium, and the crowd went wild. And that was neat to be part of.
How many people, I think, ended up actually going?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask next, yeah.
Oh, what was the number? You know, Andres Valud and I were discussing that right at the end. You know, we talked about why the registration actually gets so high. And, you know, it's partly because it's a free conference, and it's easy for everybody to say, yeah, I'd like to do that. And then apparently a lot of them don't actually manage to make it or only make it for one day because of employers say, no, you're not going to that. I want to say it was just over 200 people that were there during the time at one point or another. So it felt pretty well attended. You know, during part of the conference, it was split into two tracks. You could go into one of the rooms downstairs, one of the large classrooms, and that was pretty packed. Or you could stay up in the auditorium, you know, big auditorium seating type thing with stage and an overhead projector and stay there and listen to stuff.
So they had a big enough crowd that they had two tracks this year?
Yeah, for part of it, they ran two tracks.
And what was there a difference between the two tracks? I mean, at ESOG, I know that they've tried to have kind of a, I don't know, maybe professional's not the right word, but that's the one they always use. They have sort of the professional track and the more hobbyist side project track, if you will.
You know, I couldn't tell you. I didn't notice it on the program. I just kind of looked at the things and picked which one I wanted to go to and went back and forth between the two, depending on which one interested me more. One might be able to infer such a track if they looked at it, but you know, I don't remember noticing anything or kind of observing anything. One thing they did this year, you know, having not been there, this was something that really didn't affect me from a change perspective, but I was very grateful for, is I guess in previous years, a large amount of the conference content has been Espanol. And this year they asked all the presenters to do it in English because they're trying to make the conference an international conference. And so most of it was done in English. There were a couple presenters who kind of got the word late on that. And so their talk was Espanol, but even then, their slides were usually in English. And often I found that was good enough. I mean, it was nice when they could do in English. The Q&A session at the end would be in English usually. But even just having the slides in English was a big help.
Well, it's one of the things I've always noticed going to conferences in Europe. I guess it's a lot easier for those of us here in the U.S. to go to a conference and have them all in English. But it's got to be something of an imposition for the people who are, you know, from that area to be speaking in a language that's not their own. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine trying to do a presentation in Spanish. I mean, I took lots of Spanish in school, but I wouldn't want to try to give a presentation in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, you think, okay, I'm going to got a local conference on just down the road. You go down there and you'll have to do it in Japanese, for example. It's really quite odd because, you know, it was the sort of the same at ESUG, right? It was held in France in a French university with plenty of people from that university giving presentations and all pretty much in English.
Yeah, I thought it was very gracious of all the attendees to make the effort they did, the presenters to make the effort they did. And there were some native English-speaking attenders as well, so presenters such as myself. Dan Ingalls, of course, presented twice. Alex Worth, the guy who does Ometa and works with Alan at Viewpoint Research, I think is their name, was there, and he presented. I think those were James Foster, I shouldn't forget. He gave a gemstone presentation. And then you had some people such as Stéphane Ducasse. I don't know if I'm pronouncing Stéphane's last name right. But the one of the main benevolent dictators for Pharaoh was there. And you know, he speaks native French, of course, but did in English. And some of his students were there as well. So
let's talk about the conference and some of the things that you saw. What did you see on Thursday when you arrived?
Oh, on Thursday when I arrived jet lagged and tired. And now you want me to go back and remember what I saw?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know, Michael. It all welds together.
Well, I remember you were telling me something about an iPhone presentation.
Yes, somebody talked about. Thank you for reminding me. So there was a talk about the iPhone, and some of the things that they had done or were doing, and some of the changes that have been made recently. And they're showing how you programmed on the iPhone, and some of the things they wanted to do more because it was kind of building from the work that John McIntosh has done.
So they were using John's work. This wasn't an independent effort.
And no, it was definitely built, especially on the VM. You know, John's the main man for the VM there, as I understand it.
Right.
So yeah,
right.
Talked about that. What else? I'm looking at the thing here. I came, like I said, I got there late, so I missed the first part. I missed Stefan's I Have a Dream presentation about Pharaoh and about Smalltalk and where it could go and what it should be. The iBizlog was kind of cool. That's they talked to. That was a group of guys who were doing. Basically a bunch of glass applications, bunch of glass-based web apps, and some kind of a success progress report from that. Some guys that talked about Xtrade, and has to do with trading stuff, risk and analysis. I'm just reading down the schedule here about things I remember. Tim McKinnon was there. He was a presenter from the UK. Talked about agile project planning. A lot of good stuff there. Somewhat, you know, if you've done XP for a while, then pretty standard stuff. Andres Valud gave a great talk, I thought, about virtual machine, invisible machine. Gave some really good examples about, you know, what happens when you assume things, mostly in C code. But, you know, gave some really interesting examples about what happens if we so often we write some C code or some small talk code and we make assumptions about the way it'll work and what can go wrong, what can happen behind the scenes on you. And Gerardo Ricciardi, he had presented, I believe, at ESUG as well on various things they were doing with JIT VMs. And closed the evening with Alex, who talked about two frameworks, actually. One was an undo framework, a general-purpose undo framework without having to use the command pattern. Alex made the provocative statement that, you know, if it has the word design pattern in it, it's something you should steer clear of. And that was kind of amusing. And so later, when I actually spoke later in my presentation, I called him out on that. Because I, in one of my, in the SVG work I've been doing, I used a visitor pattern, and I called him out across the conference. Told him we should talk afterward. He could tell me how to do this better without using the visitor pattern. So we had a good fun with that. It was about that style, about that size of conference where it was, you know, small enough that you could have that kind of chat with each other as you did it, and yet big enough that you felt like there was a decent amount of people there.
Well, how did atmospheric wise, you weren't at this year's ESUG, but you've been at ESUG before, right?
Yep.
So atmospheric wise, how would you compare this to ESUG or in previous years of Smalltalk Solutions?
It's similar to ESUG, kind of. Not as much, more students there, a lot of student participation. It was held at the student university. One of the things that I guess the kind of random observations I made, and this was something I thought was neat to see, is at most Smalltalk and even most programmer conferences, there's a huge gender bias. There's a lot of guys and there's a couple girls. And there weren't as many girls as there were guys at this conference, but the bias wasn't near as obvious. There were a lot of girls there doing Smalltalk, and I thought that was cool to see, you know, not quite as bad a gender bias as I've seen in previous years. And like I say, a lot of students, a lot of very academic, but then again, a mix of local businessmen, entrepreneurs who are doing neat things with Smalltalk. So similar to ESUG, maybe, but still younger. Didn't quite have the, you know, the history of the legacy, of course.
So, what kind of commercial projects did you see going on?
I saw this iBizLog, like I talked about. So, but mostly smaller business people who. People from the area who have either left the university and gone out and done their own thing and are now reporting back of stuff they're doing. A couple different web frameworks. I think at least three web frameworks I saw people come in and talk about there. You know, MVC, Meteoroid was one of them, and the iBizLog was another, and I think there were some others.
Well, the world needs a few more web frameworks, obviously.
Yeah, Bob, well, you know, and that's fine. It was Accept was there, the German Smalltalk X, and they were there talking about Expecco, which I didn't realize is as much. It's a real life product for building all these test environments, and not just for Smalltalk, but for like C++ tests and stuff like that.
What's the name of that again?
Expecco, Expecco.
Okay.
It's a model-based test development thing, and well, the presenter is originally from Buenos Aires, but now lives in Germany and works with the nine other guys that worked at Accept, and so that was interesting to see, you know, them talking about their product and the success or not that they're having with it. Like I said, some stuff. There was a casino presentation. Some guys gave a presentation about the Smalltalk app they have that runs in a casino. That one was in Spanish, so I didn't get the entire gist of everything they're talking, but it was obvious what they were talking about was an application that runs the tables and some of the betting things, that the actual betting games that go on inside of a casino there. So that was kind of cool. There was one guy, this wasn't so much a product, but some guys were playing with eToys, but not just eToys, but eToys that actually run physical devices. So they had a bunch of Lego Mindstorm robots there.
That wasn't fidgets, was it?
No, well, it was physical eToys. So I think that it's different.
Okay.
It's a set of guys that have built, you know, eToy linkage with robotics. And I don't think they're... If I remember right from the content of their slide, they're not limited to Lego Mindstorms. That was just what they used for a demo. They actually had quite a breadth of different educational style robotics that they could interface with or were working on interfacing with. So, yeah, then good to see.
And now a short break for David Buck's Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbaron Design Minute. A while back, we encountered a potentially dangerous bug in our system. It was invoked by a seldom used menu option on the client, but the operation didn't work properly. It ended up causing corrupted data in the database. Objects that were supposed to belong to one person ended up belonging to another person, resulting in a potentially serious security risk. We were able to repair the data fairly quickly, but we needed to stop this operation from being used in the future, causing more corruption. We didn't have the option to release new client software. That would have taken months to go through the testing process. We didn't have a patching mechanism and weren't allowed to put one in. We were, however, using a gemstone database running Smalltalk code on the server, and changing methods in the centralized gemstone server was easy. So our temporary workaround was to change gemstone code specific to that one operation that would cause the client to crash. This stopped it from committing the transaction and corrupting the database. I think it's the first time I intentionally added code to make an application crash in the field because the alternative was worse. This has been the Cimbaron Design Minute. Cimbaron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbaron.com or email info@cimbaron.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast. I was just going to ask, what was the mix of Smalltalks being used there? I mean, at ESOG, we always the two big things always seem to be, well, since Faro, there are three now. There's Faro, Squeak, and VisualWorks seem to be the most common ones you run across at ESOG. What were the most commonly used Smalltalks in the presentations?
I think Squeak was the predominant one. And, you know, whether it was Faro or Squeak wasn't always obvious. But a lot, you know, in fact, three Squeaks, because Juan was there talking about Quis, which is yet another Squeak fork. So you had, you know, people like Dan Ingalls and other people who were giving stuff they showed was from Squeak or Lively Kernel. And then you have Juan talked about Quis, and he had a couple presentations based on Faro. There was at least two, mine and Andres Fortier, who talked about his mini GL work. They were both done in VisualWorks. There might have been another one. There was two that were glass-based, and I think the X-Trade one is in Visual Age.
So I'm curious about the 3D stuff, given that I've been doing OpenGL in VisualWorks. Could you talk about the mini GL?
So sure. Most of Andres's is kind of going down a different path than some of the OpenGL stuff I presented, which is Michael's stuff, which is all based on 3.0 and modern OpenGL. And Andres is more playing with 3D rendering and using older hardware, and so older APIs in some cases. He spent quite a bit of time actually talking about some of the techniques he used to limit the amount of data that went out to the card to be rendered in his display loop. And it had a lot to do with frustum culling, basically eliminating the objects. If you have a great big scene full of 20,000 triangles you want to in your scene, but realistically you're zoomed in and you're only looking at 100 of them, how do you avoid drawing those 19,900 other ones? And some of the tricks he used and different things he tried, kind of a here's where we started with timing wise, and then using these different techniques we got down to this point. And he had a little viewer that he had built in VisualWorks that showed kind of. He'd zoom things around and look at them. But a lot of it was, you know, he's experimenting with how you build these 3D models and how you interface with them. Didn't talk too much about the mini GL binding itself. So
I guess I'm going to have to look more into that, because that sounds interesting, because I don't know, the way you describe it, you might not be giving it enough credit, but it sounds like stuff that you would definitely want the graphics card to do for you.
Yeah, definitely. Isn't that something that the upcoming geometry shaders are supposed to help you with?
Geometry shaders, you can start off with a few polygons and or triangles and make more on the graphics card. So
can't you use it to reduce the amount that you're actually going to work with as well?
you tend not to do that because the graphics cards these days compute across such large sets so quickly that you're usually better off giving all the data to the graphics card and then reducing the set that you want to process over by changing which indices you access. And usually you just push all that to the GPU too. So I don't know. It might be a new way versus old way sort of divide, or maybe he's actually doing something that is different to that. I don't know. I would love to know more about it.
Well, yeah, I would be guessing at what the exact implementation is right now. Based on what I saw from the slides, my assumptions, and you know what they say about assumptions, but my assumptions would be that his current method of drawing kind of has the idea of an object and then you can tell it to render. And that means, you know, a whole OpenGL set of transactions for each object in Smalltalk you have. And so at that point, culling them becomes more important. Whereas if you've just uploaded all of them to the board, then obviously you're not going to have that as big an issue that way.
Yeah, that's that sort of immediate mode way of drawing where you say, I'm going to throw who knows what objects at this thing, and each object has its own way of rendering, which is quite kind of different. I mean, immediate mode is sort of, if you go to the OpenGL IRC channels or forums and stuff and you start discussing immediate mode, you'll sense the intense frowns from the experts at you. So I don't know. I think there is definitely benefit to being able to do that sort of thing. I mean, that's the way we draw 2D stuff usually, but
it's not great for exploration, right?
It's certainly not going to give you the power of the graphics card doing that.
Right. Yep. So, you know, another highlight for me was, again, Dan's closing remarks, Dan Engel's closing remarks. And, you know, I really liked this because Dan showed some of the classic things. If you've ever seen a Dan Engel's presentation, it's just classic fun with Squeak. But one of the things I thought Dan did really well was talk about a sort of balance, about having fun both in – and he even explicitly said that because, you know, Dan has a real love for physics and doing fun stuff that aren't just programming as well. And I thought he did a great job of kind of demonstrating finding these fun types of things to do, this creative expression in software but out of software as well. He showed some experiments that he and his son have done, fun experiments, things like strapping leaf blowers to skateboards and seeing how fast you can get the skateboard going, and some other fun physics projects he's had. There was a pneumatic gate that could be driven by air pressure. And I really enjoyed that, I think. Especially, you know, Dan, I don't know what Dan's age is, but Dan's been doing this for a while, and I think as a role model, he put up a great role model for a lot of these, especially these younger software engineers, about this balance of finding fun in programming as well as outside of programming and the synergy that can take place between the two. So that was pretty cool, for me at least.
Yeah, there's way too much emphasis in computing on, you know, your boring staple data entry type applications. Sucks the life out of programming in many respects.
And even sometimes the really, really geeky programming stuff, you know, even going transcending that, you know, finding ways to see the synthesis both for creativity inside the computer as well as creativity outside the computer. It was interesting. A lot of his slides were like napkin sketches that had been scanned. And then he was showing this napkin sketch. And I really liked that mix. It was almost like these XKCD, you know, cartoons type things where he would show some of the real world metaphors he had behind, for example, BitBlit, when he built the first BitBlit, you know, back in, and people have talked stories about how, you know, they went over there and BitBlit was working, but then it got hit by a fraction and blew up, and they just made a quick change and suddenly it was working again. And how he had in his mind this impression of these two plates sliding back and forth with a roller in between. And, you know, these real world metaphors that help drive some of these creative things we do in software. So I thought that was pretty cool.
So explain, how did he come up with BitBlit then?
Well, in this case, you know, he had this notion, hard to do without the napkin drawings that he had there, but, you know, he visualized it as these two planes which were going in opposite directions, and in between them was a wheel. you know, and as the wheel went, it was kind of like a stamp roller wheel, as it pulled, you know, markers off one, and or pulled the information off the one plane, and then repainted it on the other plane as it went by. And he said this was important because it helped him realize how he could do bit-blit efficiently with only two or one, you know, intermediate state variables to do it. And it was just neat to see a lot of the kind of these ideas, real world ideas that drove some of these other ideas. And that's the one that comes to mind. He did some fun demos with Lively Kernel as well. And some of the things, some of the hopes he had for that. And that, of course, drew some of the questions that I think any tried and true, born in the blue small talker would ask is, what does this mean that you didn't use small talk to do it? And if you did it, you know, if you could have used small talk, would you do it again? I think he did a pretty good job of trying to answer that.
Isn't the answer to that is that he did do it in small talk? It's Squeak.
Well, yeah, I think so. And I think he tried to be careful as far as not offending anybody from the small talk community, but at the same time saying, you know, this was an opportunity with JavaScript being so ubiquitous via the browser to get these same ideas in a much wider spread audience and not restrict it to people having to download a plugin or something like that.
What did he say about how widespread the Lively kernel is getting? I mean, how much is that being used?
He said, you know, at one point he made a comment which made me believe that not as much as he'd like. And that was really all I could draw from that. But I mean, he made the comment at some point, you know, this isn't taking over the world either, the Lively kernel stuff. But it's a great tool for exploring, doing interactive media, and it certainly broadened the scope of what there was before. I'm trying to remember. He talked some about his experience with Sun and how they, of course, you know, there was some parallel project and they wanted everything. They wanted to somehow link the two, and some of the surprises that made as they showed him how easy it was in Lively Kernel to do these things. They had a photo viewer manipulator where you could look at different photo, you know, the photo viewer, and showed how he could just pull the inner, and they said, well, you know, the slider should be up here instead of down there. And so they did the classic Squeak, the morphic thing of just, you know, popping open the halos and rearranging the widgets and saying, okay, there, it's there. And he said that blew him away when they did that and just kind of rearranged the UI on the fly.
Yeah. What about live debugging? I mean, is he able to, I'm guessing not, but you know, that's kind of the other one that blows people away when it comes to these dynamic programming environments like Smalltalk.
You know, we talked about that. In fact, that was my question when we talked to the, you know, when we took the question and answer period at the end. Because, you know, we talked about a number of the things which have come from the Smalltalk world and how are now, you know, how dynamic is winning, how dynamic is or gaining traction, and how duck typing is gaining traction, and how garbage collection is gaining traction. And one of the things we talked about there, Dan talked a couple times about the history between Smalltalk 72, 76, 78, and 80, and what things came at each point. And apparently, I hadn't known this before, but the whole closure model fell in place in Smalltalk 76. And between 76 and 78 was where they really got the wow. We could go nuts with block closures. We could use them for our entire control logic, which is something no other language has really ever done, as far as I know, is taking closures to that level and saying, let's just do it for all, but use it for everything. And it said that was a bit of a struggle to get block closures right at first, but they eventually got it. So this led me to the question at the end, you know, it's like, okay, a lot of these things are being done, but one of the aha moments as you go along the small talk path of enlightenment is when you discover that contexts are real objects, because he'd talked about how he'd realized one weekend while he was away from work and at the beach with his family how he'd realized how he wanted context to work and how that should be a real object too, and then it, you know, he didn't realize at the time how powerful that would be, but how the debugger just fell into place because of it. And I asked, you know, I said, you know, this is something the other systems haven't seen yet. And, you know, what do you think about that? He said, yeah, that was too bad. That was something obviously none of these other systems really had yet. And he says, you know, they try to emulate it. picture, you know, in Eclipse you have a debugger, and these other places are building debuggers, but no one has really got to the point yet of opening that part of the programming model to programmers in the same way that Smalltalk has.
You know, some of that's not just because the tools aren't up to it. Some of it's, I think, a mental block in a way. I've had so many conversations with people in the Ruby community, for instance, when I've gone out and given talks, where you'll get people telling you that if you're in the debugger, you've made a mistake. I mean, it's almost like a religious belief that the debugger is not your friend in some communities.
Yeah, if you have to brag about your debugger, then what does that say about your need for the debugger type thing? And
right.
Yeah, it's just getting past that and realizing the value of learning, which really was always kind of at the core of the Smalltalk essence, was the value of learning about your program. And, you know, people over the years have played with, do we rename the debugger as the process inspector or the context explorer or something like that, to try and throw off that stigma, because that's really what it is. But, yeah, I don't know what the answer is to that long term. Part of me believes that maybe we're just getting to a point where maybe that even that stigma will begin to break down.
I suspect so.
I mean, Michael, you would know better than this, but I mean, better than me. But in the JavaScript world, isn't Firebug and things like that considered pretty essential?
Oh yeah.
Even as somewhat primitive as it may be, I think as you go dynamic, you have to interact more with your program to get your program right.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why Flash is so successful is because the development environment is dynamic. Mm-hmm. You know, you get in there and you're an animator and you don't know that much about programming, and you can do this very simple scripting, put together these keyframe animations and sling all this stuff together. Oh, and by the way, you can then put it on the internet. And all the tools are geared around this idea that, you know, you're in a live animation environment where you could script things. So, you know, you look at ActionScript with the Flash and stuff, and all of the tools are custom. All of those tools are built by them. You know, you don't go out to your to Notepad or TextMate or anything like that to create your Flash scripts generally. You've got the full environment there. And it's the exact same reason that it works, that Smalltalk works, and why it won, really, when it comes to interactivity on the web, and the Microsoft's Silverlight and whatnot are still struggling to catch up, simply because, you know, it's dynamic and alive. I think it's more about being alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the idea, I think from our perspective, being dynamic helps you be live, but I think the key thing is what you just said. It has to be live, because if it's not live, it's so much harder to figure out what's going on. I mean, even stupid things, the thing that I've tried to get across to so many people with the debugger is just, why should I try to keep all that state in my head? Even if you're using unit tests, why should I try to keep all that state in my head instead of just saying, you know, the hell with it, I'm not that smart. Let me just open a debugger and see what it all looks like.
You mean a context explorer, right?
Yeah.
Michael, I think you say it really well when you say, you know, live. And I that would be, you know, per Dan, some of Dan's stuff. They didn't call it dynamic kernel. They called it lively kernel. And I think that's same lines.
And now a short break for this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Three of the five new jobs in this week's report are in Buenos Aires, Argentina. After seeing an Argentinian job posting on LinkedIn, I did some searching on the web to see if the same posting was available elsewhere for people who were not on LinkedIn. I found that posting and two others to boot. Unfortunately, since I cannot speak or write Spanish, I have to rely on online translators for a rough idea on what is being asked for in a posting. If you or anyone you know would be willing to help us track jobs in Spanish or Portuguese countries, please send them my way, jsavage@texas.net. On with the new jobs for this week. Buenos Aires, Argentina. IBM and Sensei SRL are looking for an analista programador Smalltalk who also has experience with AIX, Unix, shell scripts, and is fluent in the English language. Experience with DB2 is considered a plus for this permanent position. Buenos Aires, Argentina. Huenye Consultora Informatica is looking for an analista programador junior who has experience with Smalltalk. Experience that is considered a plus includes VisualWorks, VisualAge, Oracle, UML, RUP, XML, MQ Series, and Gemstone. Buenos Aires, Argentina. NewX Argentina SA has a permanent position for an analista programador who has Smalltalk experience and is fluent in the English language. Experience that is considered a plus includes Java, Lotus Notes, SQL, IBM Relational Application Developer, WSAD, HTML, Install Shield, and Web Services Application Server, WSAS. In the USA, New York, New York, J.P. Morgan Chase has a permanent position for an IB Tech Application Support Analyst Associate. They are looking for experience with Unix, Solaris, and Linux system administration, Gemstone, new server configuration, shell scripts, debugging skills, network storage solutions, and network communications. Experience that is considered a plus includes Samba administration, Citrix administration, Gemstone DBA, and Smalltalk. Omaha, Nebraska. Data Group, Modus, and Agile Enterprise Solutions are looking for a Smalltalk developer who also has experience with relational databases and has good communication skills. Experience with VisualWorks is considered a plus. This 6-month contract pays up to $45 an hour. The jobs listed in this report are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs, or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
I really find it kind of puzzling sometimes, right? Because I've seen some guys doing Linux kernel development, and they're doing device drivers. They don't compile their device driver and restart the kernel over and over again to get it right. They do it live. You know, they've got their program there. They've got the hardware there. They just talk straight to the hardware. The interaction cycle between communicating with the hardware and seeing the results is rather small. You know, so why is it that then you shut that off and then make that something static that you can't ever get to? And it's not really a protection thing. I mean, anybody who wants to can go in there and change the stuff anytime they want anyway. So, you know, even at the very lowest levels, this whole idea of making things dead and blocked off perpetuates all the way up to the very top levels of abstraction in our computing world in general. I don't really understand how it's happened, but it may be an artifact of the 1980s and 1990s need for speed, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know.
The need for speed.
Another interesting topic that came up in some of these discussions as people asked questions, both in here and in the security one, is this continuing idea of security. And Dan theorized out loud, you know, or wondered, not even, you know, people asked him, would you do it differently or would you emphasize? And he wondered what would happen if, you know, if they had traded some of the research they were doing in the early days and even in the continuing years. I'm trying to figure out how to make you know, how to have the object revolution, but have it in a secure, in a provably secure way. And, you know, if you could go to a bank and say, yeah, your ATM will use objects, but it's provably secure, for whatever that means, what would that mean? And, versus, you know, the more classic compiled, secure, type checked type, feeling that comes from that.
Isn't that kind of what Gilad Braca is trying to do with Newspeak?
Yeah, and we talked about that. That was actually a discussion that Dan and I walked back from the restaurant one day. And I myself am skeptical about this. I blogged before about this, and I even kind of shared my thoughts there as far as, you know, if we say that in computing we draw metaphors from the real world, and if we look at the real world security systems, you know, they're rather ad hoc. The way security works in your own personal life, you choose to accept the overhead of locking your front door based on the risk of how likely you think somebody will break into your house, or locking your car, and you know, basically we pick and choose based on what we're doing, based on how much overhead we're willing to burden ourselves with to feel more secure. And if that was the case, what does that mean for the security thing? Because my impression is I've seen many computer scientists, well-known celebrity-ranked computer scientists, basically crash themselves on this rock of security without anybody really having any revolutionary success yet. And
actually, I read something quite the contrary to success today on Slashdot about how you can make shell injection scripts that look like English and quite deadly. So the idea that you could potentially filter out dangerous scripts coming into your application because of certain keywords that are required for the language of the shell is completely busted now based on what these guys were able to do.
Right. So I'm forgetting the guy's name, but when he did the guy who gave the presentation on the secure VM, he talked about some of these different security models that people have tried to apply to various VM technologies, whether they be Smalltalk or other things, and the ins and outs of them. Dan's reaction to my comments were interesting. You know, he said, I don't have an answer, but I can react. And his one interesting comment was that while we can say that computing imitates life, so to speak, or art imitates life, computing art imitates life, it works on different scales. There are things in computing that are just so vastly simple to do, so efficient to do, that we don't do them in life. And so the analogs don't always hold up. And so he was challenging my assertion there. That was great. It was a neat discussion to have. And so I guess I've got my brain thinking again about, well, maybe it's possible. But you know, he admitted readily that as of yet he's seen no one even approach what needs to happen. He's excited that people are looking at the problem. He also mentioned language E, which is very bent on security, and Galad drew some of his work from that. He's excited that people are doing that because he considers that something that needs to happen. But he admitted at the same time that at this point we're still pretty just bashing our head against a rock so far. And it's his hope. He's hopeful that someday that revolution will happen. What it looks like,
no one knows yet. I think Michael is itching to get to his PDX Smalltalk meetup. So I think with that sounds like a good wrap-up for the podcast. Yeah, thanks for coming on and talking about Smalltalk's 2009 and all the other stuff that came up. That was really cool.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Travis.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk. Flush the toilet now, Michael. That way we can get all that unpleasantness out of the way.
That way we can get that behind us.
That was cheap.
That was good. That was good wordplay.
I didn't say it wasn't good wordplay. I just said it was cheap.